Good afternoon. My name is Stephen Watson, and today we are here to celebrate the life of Clancy Emlislin. Clancy was an amazing man who I loved and respected dearly. I am going to now read a biography of his life.
Clarence Arnold Emlislin Jr., known to the rest of us as Clancy, was born in Eau Claire, Wisconsin on July 9, 1927, and died in Los Angeles on August 24, 2020. He was 93 years old and an actively sober in Alcoholics Anonymous for over 61 years. An only child, he left Eau Claire to answer the call to fight in World War II and join the Merchant Marines at 16 and the U.S. Navy at 17, where he served our country and learned to drink. Alcohol would first save and broaden his life, then unravel it, then almost kill him. In 1949, he married a beautiful dark-haired girl he met in college named Charlotte Kohler. And together they became, in Clancy's words, the country's premier distributor of Catholics. They moved to El Paso in the 1950s with three little girls, Mary, Christine, and Kathy. After Clancy went out for milk one night and stayed out for 3 days, Charlotte stole all the furniture, told the girls to say goodbye, and moved to a small apartment. Clancy's downward spiral had begun and the bottom was not easily found. After drifting in and out of AA meetings, enjoying the free donuts and coffee and helping himself to the seventh tradition basket, he went from a dream job at a top flight ad agency to hospitals and institutions. In between, he and Charlotte managed to have another daughter, Susan, who explains that her dad was apparently very appealing when on Thorazine. He drove to Los Angeles to seek a new life, stopping in Arizona long enough to get arrested and have his front teeth kicked out in the Phoenix drunk tank. On a rainy Halloween in 1958, he was thrown out of the midnight mission for fighting. And finding no friendly direction to go, he walked 71 blocks to an Alano club where he knew he could get food and dry his clothes. What he found, though, was sobriety and the beginning of a life guided by an AA sponsor that no one could have predicted. After 5 years of sobriety, he and Charlotte and the family reunited. Charlotte had found Al-Anon and gave decades of service to families and people who loved an alcoholic. He brought the family to Los Angeles, where they had a son, Clancy Jr. He got a job at a radio station, KHJ, where he created the station's Boss Radio identity in the 1960s and helped turn the station into a powerhouse. In 1963, he sat at his kitchen table and wrote the format for what would become the Pacific Group. The format is still in use today. What started as a ragtag gathering of seven people at Ohio Street grew to becoming the largest weekly meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in the world. It is renowned for its emphasis on action, structure, sponsorship, and living out of the program outlined in our book, Alcoholics Anonymous. In the beginning, he gave up his evenings to sit with desperate drunks and to make sure ones who stayed sober didn't give in to that strange impulse to drink right before they turned 1 year sober. Thus began the group's tradition of a watch. He and Charlotte opened up their house to a couple of drunks who found themselves with perilous, unscheduled time one Saturday. They played croquet. The next Saturday, more people came, and from that was born the yard, which grew to over 100 men and women every Saturday. When someone pulled together enough funds to get a new apartment or home, dozens of AAs appeared in front of 1212 Lake Street on a Sunday morning to help them. That became a move. He left his career in 1974 to take an interim position at the Midnight Mission, explaining he couldn't resist the decrease in salary. The intern job lasted for the next 46 years. His gifts as a communicator and his guidance with the 12 steps philosophy helped the Midnight Mission grow from its original structure to the modern expanded facility it is today. Clancy was constantly on the road sharing his message, either at an airport or driving his car. Anyone who ever drove with him knows God must have been looking after someone in that car. He was, above all, a communicator with the uncanny facility for gaining the trust of a suffering alcoholic almost immediately. Guided further into AA way of life by Chuck C, the only person who made Clancy dance around him like an eager newcomer. Clancy was a messenger whose observations about alcoholism and his own recovery made drunks see him as one of them. He would talk to anybody about alcoholism, from astronauts to politicians to Oscar-winning actors to the most befuddled newcomer escaping the streets to land in Clancy's office on Skid Row. He had, as our current secretary said recently, solutions of action that seemed to work even when nothing else would. And all were rooted in AA's steps and traditions. As long as someone was trying, Clancy would reel out as much kindness and encouragement as they needed. He revered Alcoholics Anonymous and decided his energy to being of service to countless men and women suffering from alcoholism. His reputation for service and communication are unparalleled. There will never be anyone like him. When I and my peers got together, Clancy always gathered three or four of us in a circle as he was going to impact a gem of wisdom. We stood eagerly waiting for him to throw his arms around the shoulders of the closest one. "I want you to know that you are the future of Alcoholics Anonymous," he said gravely, and with the next breath adding, "and I'm glad I won't be alive to see it." Then he would shove us off and he would strut away. That's how a lot of us will remember him, the old man, the old fox. He seemed old when some of us young guys first got here, but something phenomenal happened. Over the years, with his encouragement, example, and a simple lesson about life and service, we got old and we became the future of AA. And ha, he had to see it. And Clancy, he stayed the same, filled with energy, enthusiasm, his dazzling wit intact, and always ready to offer reassuring word to someone trying to surrender to a higher power that they couldn't see. We got old, he stayed the old fox. We will do the best with what he gave us. It is our responsibility and our pleasure. Thank you. So today we're gonna have some participants share. And the first participant is an old dear friend of his, Johnny Harris.
My name is Johnny Harris, and I'm an alcoholic. Glad to be here tonight, glad to be sober. I feel really honored about participating in this thing because Clancy and I have been dear friends. It broke down into three segments for a while. In the 60s, we were friends, and then he became a sponsor in the second segment. And in the last maybe 20 years of his life, he became like a big brother to me. And one of the things that bound us so close together was my closeness with his sponsor, who claimed that Clancy was the only guy he ever sponsored. That's just the way it was. But I learned a great deal from that old man because he was like a father I've ever known. And the last year he lived in his life, as I visited with him, he said this, and I took it. It's made more sense to me than anything that I know of. He said, "It seems stupid to think that the life begins at the cradle and ends at the grave." He also said that leaving here is just like going home, changing your clothes, and going to another room somewhere. Those are philosophies and things that I lived with all these years. One of my great blessings is to be able to have been able to sit Wednesday night next to my sponsor, Clancy, get him a cup of coffee and meet him at his car and walk him into the meeting, where he seemed to have some type of energy that flopped on him when he went into that room. It was almost like somebody gave him a shot of speed or something. And the years and years that I got to ride in that car with him as we went to Laguna Beach for a meeting with our papa and then to Carlsbad workshop on the first Thursday of January. Riding in the car with him was an experience all on its own. Mary said to me not long ago when he was still up and around, she said, I'm afraid riding to Clancy in the car. Well, most of us know what that's like. And she said, "You ride with him a lot, Johnny." And I said, "Yes, I do." And she said, "Well, what do you do?" I said, "Well, I get in the car hook up my seatbelt, and start praying. I don't know what it done for anybody else, but that says so much about him. He's always been somebody that I walked side by side with and tried to do the thing that he did that brought about his life. And by no means, shape, or form, as busy as I ever got in Alcoholics Anonymous, I could not keep up with Clancy Emerson. I did a lot. I went a lot of places and did a lot of things with him. Basically, he and I traveled all over the world together. And memories that I have of him will carry me forever. I'll tell you, I was at a Mexican Catholic funeral for somebody that I sponsored a long time ago. And from time to time, I always felt the presence of Papa Chuck in my car with me. And I thought, well, are you hallucinating or you're thinking or what you going to do? But there was a little Filipino priest at that mass that said something that just cemented my life tremendously. And this is it. He said that if you love somebody, they will never leave you. And for us who claim to love Clancy Emerson with all of our hearts and recognition for what he's done, the legacy he left us will be hard, hard to fulfill. But I want you to know that as long as I'm taking a breath in and out, Clancy Emerson will live in my heart, and I'll try to fulfill the legacy that he left me. Thank you very much, and I love y'all.
Thank you, Johnny. Next, we're going to hear from Sharon Crane.
Hi, my name is Sharon. I'm an alcoholic. They say Longfellow actually says, when a great man dies, for years the light he leaves behind him lies on the paths of men. I know that there were so many of us that felt the shift in the earth on August 24th. I first of all want to thank all the Emerslands for all of the opening of their home on Saturdays and more. And let us come into their ragtag bunch, come into your home. And for many, many years, you took our calls, you took the messages, and as he would say, listen to our drivel. I want to wish you peace and grace at this time of your life, and I want to let you know I appreciate your going beyond what was customary. Thank you so much. Clancy was my sponsor for 35 of my 45 years, and he got me at a very tough time in my life. I sat in his living room on the fireplace and sobbed for about 2 minutes when I asked him. And he waited for me to take a breath. He said, okay, we'll try. And we tried, and he tried, and he tried, and he did a great job. That was a year of my betrayal, my divorce, and I wasn't listening to him. I didn't hear him. And one night, he saw that I was headed somewhere to do some damage at the Saturday night meeting, and he stopped me, and very kindly, because he never spoke to me harshly at those times. He stopped and he put one hand on one shoulder, one hand on the other shoulder, and he said, Sharon, you will walk through this with dignity and grace so you can be an example to others. And I heard him. And I began to read an inventory to him about my wrongs. And that stone he gave me to make the ripple for being an example of dignity and grace still goes far and wide. Thank you, Clancy. It was a paramount for day. I never gave up that battle very easily, but Clancy Emerson walked me through it. I remember a time when I had no money that year, and I was having Thanksgiving, and there was a knock at the back door. I had a couple of Cornish hens in the freezer, and from the mission, he sent turkey and all of the trimmings and gave us Thanksgiving. I remember at the yard one day when my son was trying to get the volleyball over the net. He was small, and we were all eating. And Clancy put down his hot dog, walked over, and he helped my son learn how to put that ball over the net. And it was a banner day for my child because many years later, he won a tri-state volleyball tournament. Thank you, Clancy. Never was he happier than when Casey and I eloped. After 18 years of dating, he was really happy. Actually, we made the poop sheet that next Wednesday. I realized that my sponsor understood what I was facing when my husband got malignant melanoma. I trusted him. He told me to go travel, leave work. And my husband and I traveled in the last years of his life, and we had some irreplaceable memories. His wisdom was far beyond what I would know, and I'm so grateful that he helped me face that. When my husband died, Clancy was out of town, yet I received so much love. When my mother died, I was out of town, yet I received so much love. When my father was killed in an accident, Clancy was in Africa, yet I received so much love. The enormous amount of the Pacific Group, and what we do is Clancy created this community that we don't just care, we show up. The last time I sat with him before our Wednesday meeting, I was watching how gracious he had become, even when he was tired, to welcome all the people that were wanting to shake his hand and meet him. I sat with him for a while and we were quiet. One night I had said something to him, complaining about my life, and he just looked at me and he said, "It's because you're defiant." He always gave me truth with hope. Thank you for that, sponsor. I'm sure you left me in good shape. You left many of us in good shape. I know with everything that I think I know, I'll do my best to honor you. I have learned that action is the magic word. My mother slept at night because I found the group and stayed. My son knows that having a coffee pot on in the house is a good thing. And it was the Tuesday after your passing. It's my call time, and I couldn't call you. And I couldn't call heaven. I didn't have the number. So what I did was I went into a Zoom meeting, and this leader asked this young man to read chapter 5. And the young man picked up his book, put it in front of him, opened it to the page, and before he started reading, he took off his baseball hat. And that was a blessing from Clancy Imusland. "I will look for the endless blessings you have left for me every day, in the wag of a dog, in the quiet of the room when we read chapter 5 and know that there's hope, in the unexpected visit of a hummingbird, in the joy that a new one finds when they finally claim their seat. I am humbled to have walked with you in your footsteps for all these years. You have been my guide to the mother lode of gold. You have shown me how to mine it and how to give it away for the rest of my life. The language of the heart never dies. I love you, sponsor. I miss you until we meet again. Thank you."
Thank you, Sharon. Tom Bouchard.
I'm Tom Bouchard, and I'm an alcoholic. I am grateful to be here, and I'm humbled to be here, to have been chosen to say something about the man that made such a profound difference in my life over the last 39 and a half years. I came to, like Steve had written or in the prologue, I divorced a wife, quit a job, and drove 3,000 miles to California. Because I thought that would change my life. And it did, not in the way I expected. I knew nothing of AA. I had drank for 17 years and never tried to quit. Never saw the necessity to quit. And when I got here, my father had passed away suddenly 6 months prior to my leaving Maine. And it was sudden. It was... I think I went into a depression and I came up with those three solutions. And when I got to California, I wasn't here for very long and found out that, nothing had changed. I felt the same way I did when I left Maine, and I couldn't figure it out. And I looked up an old bar manager of mine from back east, and he was in Culver City. And it so happened he was about 90 days sober and was in a thing called the Pacific Group and had a sponsor and was doing the deal. And it was, when he opened the door, it was the eyes of AA that met me. This guy looked better than I'd ever known him. And he was my entrance to Alcoholics Anonymous. That was my introduction. I'd never been with you people. And for the next a little over 3 years, Clancy was my grand sponsor. And then when my sponsor left town, I went to the source. And, you know, he explained the disease of alcoholism better than anybody I've ever known or listened to or heard in AA. I believe that was his gift. And I've also, you know, he's taught me so many things over the years. The aspect of sponsorship, you know, I've come to understand that Clancy's sponsor was the people he sponsored. And that's the way it works. It works for me. I would come to understand that it's hard to tell people, tell sponsees what to do without doing it yourself. And I've come to find out that they keep me in line. And no, these are all things that, as was mentioned by the previous sharers, that the ethic of the Pacific Group, which I was introduced to, has, like I said, profoundly changed my life. I can remember at about 11 years sober, I was in a financial pickle, and we had exhausted everything. And this was 1992. I was looking for work. I'd been looking to work for 6 months. And I got an offer for a job that was going to pay me, you know, not even half of what my monthly nut was. And, you know, Clancy said in his way of saying things, take the job, kid. And I went, you know, Clance, I tried to explain to him that I was going to lose the house and, you know, things just weren't going to go well. This isn't a good idea. And he cut me off. He said, just take the job, kid. And I took the job. And sure enough, 19 years later, I was able to retire with that company with a pension. And I'd have never taken that job if it wasn't for direction and taking action that I was taught here in the Pacific Group. The last time I spent time with him was Super Bowl Sunday in February. And, you know, he knew at that point that, you know, he was declining. He was definitely declining. It upset him a lot that the mental faculty was starting to go. And you know, he said, Tom, I'm tired. And I knew that basically he was at a point where, you know, it was okay with him to leave. And that was the last time I saw him in a physical sense. But he will always be with me. As Sharon said, he'll be in my heart. I know that it's, you know, the people that are sharing here today, it's our responsibility along with many, many others to carry on the legacy that Clancy has so freely left us. And I will miss him. And rest in peace, my friend. I love you.
Thank you, Tom. Next, can we hear from Cindy Coleman?
My name is Cindy Coleman. Clancy was my sponsor for the last 39 of my 43 years of sobriety. I'd like to take this opportunity to offer my condolences to the family and express my appreciation for sharing Clancy with us. I don't think they had any choice in the matter, and I suspect he didn't have much choice either. Clancy sponsored many people, and when asked how many, he always said, one less than I need. I have a few short stories that depict Clancy in a sponsorship. In AA, there are 12 steps alcoholics take so they no longer find it necessary to drink. The fourth step is an inventory of our spiritual, emotional, and mental handicaps, and we share that with our sponsor in the fifth step. When Clancy listened to Fifth Steps, he listened to the inventory as he drove up Pacific Coast Highway, and the AA baby sat with a flashlight and read their inventory. He always turned around at Camarillo Mental Institution. There was always the fear that he would drop you off before returning home. The ninth step requires that we make restitution for the harm we caused because of our alcoholism. When I was nearly three, my mother ended up losing custody of my brothers and me because of her drinking. I was reunited with her when I was 1 year sober, and mishandled it. I was rude and disrespectful. If you asked me at the time if I wanted a relationship with my mother, I would have said, I don't care. When I finished reading my inventory to Clancy, he said, you remind me so much of myself. You care so much that you don't care. I replied, no, sir, I really don't care. And that looked like and felt like the truth, but the sponsor always knows better. And the truth is, I care so much, I can't stand it. He instructed me to, as a part of the amends process, send a card to her once a month. After a few years, I was finally able to make face-to-face amends to my mother. Thank God AA showed me how to make amends. After asking what I could do to set right my wrongs, someone told me if their answer is too vague, ask for specifics. When I asked my mother what I could do to set this right, she responded, be a good daughter. I asked, what does that look like? She said, you can start by calling me mom. I asked, what else? She said, you can conclude our telephone calls with, I love you. I've done that now for the last 25 years. Left to my own devices, I would not have a relationship with my mother. Sponsor direction restored her dignity as a mother. I'll share another story of Clancy before I conclude. When I grew up, things happened in the neighborhood that shouldn't happen. The experience left me impacted by the cold. Try being an Eskimo and being capable of handling the cold. Anyway, while growing up, whenever I got too physically cold, I broke out in big, painful red welts. Some of you know Clancy used to be a heavy smoker. The night I read my personal inventory, it was raining hard and it was very windy and was very cold. As we drove up PCH, I shivered as he smoked because he rolled his window down so the smoke would leave the car. When I got to the part about how the cold affected me, he put out a cigarette, rolled up his window and turned on the heater full blast. I haven't been affected by the cold since. Who thinks to do that? And finally, I asked Clancy once what he loved most about his children. I thought he was going to list attributes for each of his children, but he replied, what I love most about my children is how much they love one another. Because when we're gone, I know they will love and care for one another. Thank you, and I miss you, Clancy.
Thank you, Cindy. Alan Bernstein.
Good afternoon. My name is Alan Bernstein, and I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is April 16, 1990, and 21 years ago, on July 12, 1999, Clancy Immislin became my sponsor. At the time Clancy took on my case, I conducted a program which revolved around self-will, intense examination of my emotions, and a regular inventory process to capture and catalog the way my family, my friends, and my fellow A members had disappointed me. I was physically sober, but I was, in the words of our AA literature, idling in a retrogressive groove. Clancy kicked me back into gear. He insisted I attend the yard every Saturday morning. The world is full of people of all races, religions, creeds, and orientations who are good athletes. I was not one of them. Every week I showed up, I mowed the lawn, I missed the ball, I glared at you. I'm a good negotiator, and I'd like to tell you that I negotiated my attendance with Clancy, but there was no negotiating with Clancy Immislin when he was your sponsor. I just kept showing up. Finally, after almost a year, I learned how to hit the ball. One time I even got a home run. Alcoholics Anonymous is a program that allows people like me and like many of you, people who have been crippled by self-centered fear, to learn to rely on a power greater than ourselves and to get out of self by taking good and consistent actions. At the yard, Clancy taught me how to walk through fear. It opened up a world for me that mere physical sobriety had not afforded me. I started sponsoring men in the group. I took on small leadership positions. I started my own business. In 2003, I went down to the mission and told Clancy I was going to become a father. Today, it's more common, but there weren't many gay men back then starting families. I wasn't sure how Clancy would take the news. He told me that being a dad was a hard commitment, but that it was the best commitment a man could ever hope to have. And he promised that if I showed the same dedication to my family that I had shown to my AA commitments, that he would be there for me 100%. And he was. Over the next 2 years, I became a father of three. I don't know where else hopeless, self-obsessed losers are transformed through good action into loving and consistent fathers, successful businessmen, respected community leaders. But that's what Clancy gave me and so many other hopeless alcoholics over the years. In 2016, Clancy told me he wanted me to be secretary of our big Wednesday night meeting. I'd already been secretary of some of the smaller Pacific Rim meetings, and I'd been in the Wednesday runoff a few years earlier. In our group, it was pretty well known that while Clancy's support was an indescribable honor, the general term best applied to Clancy's candidate was runner-up. Somehow that year, the group elected me. To my mind, Clancy gave the world three incredible contributions: his family, who he loved so dearly, and to whom I extend my deepest condolences, his 40 plus years of the Midnight Mission, and his creation of the Pacific Group. That year as secretary gave me a different perspective on the group. What had often seemed before to be a bunch of arbitrary rules and instructions transformed for me into a unified set of values, although I had heard Clancy extol them many times over the years. Be where you say you're going to be when you said you were going to be there. Do what you said you would do. Guard the errant tongue, especially when talking to people who aren't in a position to argue back. I miss Clancy so much. I know we all do. But I also sense that we are the beneficiaries of his legacy, and that we each can do our part to continue that tradition of good action, of faith, of love and service in Alcoholics Anonymous. So here in front of a few thousand of my favorite people, I pledge to do my part to continue that and ask you to consider doing the same. And finally, I say to Clancy, thank you for this good life and for your example of a life truly well lived. I love you and always will. Farewell, sir.
Thank you, Alan. Next, may we hear from Marilyn Slater.
Hi, I'm Marilyn, and I am an alcoholic. That beautiful slideshow reminded me of something Chuck C. said. He said that a measure of your spirituality is the number of people you're connected to. And that was Clancy. To be asked to talk about Clancy is indeed an honor, but it's truly daunting to talk about a person as complex, influential, and as life-changing as Clancy. I knew Clancy for all of my 48 sober years, and Clancy was my sponsor for the last 30. I was taken to the Pacific Group by my first sponsor in 1972, and I saw immediately that Clancy's influence was everywhere. He wasn't like any other human being. I remember every encounter I had with him in those early years. Not only did I learn something each time, but my life was changed for the better. It was like a trip to the dentist. It was often painful, but I was better off for having gone. Once when I was late for a commitment to make coffee, Clancy heard about it and said, "If your job is to make coffee, show up on time and make coffee. Don't defend your mistakes. Learn from them and change your behavior." Well, it was painful humiliation, but my behavior started to improve after that. And later those words served me well when I went back to work. We moved to San Francisco and I lost touch with the Pacific Group until I was 18 years sober. And even though we moved back to Los Angeles, I went to quieter AA meetings and my life was gray. Somehow after a trip to Israel, I wanted more and I was led to return to the Pacific Group. And that was my birthplace, but I came without a sponsor. And it was Mary M. who cajoled me out of my sponsor resistance, and I will be forever grateful to Mary for pushing me to ask Clancy to be my sponsor. Now that was 30 years ago. Clancy had power over my life. When I turned a problem over to Clancy, there was no question about whether I would take his direction. In that sense, he had great power, but he always pointed out that he had power over people only by their consent. There were not many times in these later years when Clancy had to exert the power that I gave him. But one of those times was when I was 40 years sober. I was speaking at the State Line Retreat in Las Vegas, and Clancy was also speaking there. I talked on Friday night, and by midnight that evening, I got word that our beloved son had committed suicide. I called Clancy's room at the hotel, and I woke him up, and of course he was a bit grumpy until I told him why I called. And he quickly changed into life-saving sponsor. There was no question that I would do what he said. He reminded me that I had 40 years of sobriety with a strong program and that my husband was at home alone with no program. It was up to me to be his strength for a while. I was to drive home and comfort him. And like a post-hypnotic suggestion, I got into the car and I made the five-hour drive across the desert and take what had been given to me in AA and go home to help our family recover from the unthinkable. In these 9 years that have followed, most of my times with Clancy were as the admiring sponsee with the elder statesman, listening to his jokes, hearing his great talks, just watching the way he poured out his life for the rest of us. Words are not adequate to sum up the love I had for him and the positive impact that he made on my life. So I'm going to close just by simply saying, thank you. Thank you, dear Clancy. And thank you, dear God, for giving us Clancy.
Thank you, Marilyn. Next, may we hear from Nancy Morris.
Hello, everybody. My name is Nancy Morris. First of all, I would like to thank Mary, Christine, Kathy, Susan, and Clance for sharing your home and your dad with us for all of these years. Many years ago, I had a little bronze old fox statue made, and it was inscribed to him, "There will never be another you." And he was definitely one of a kind. He was my sponsor for 47 of my 49 years. I started going to the yard right away. So every Saturday, as been mentioned, hundreds of us, or a little over 100, would descend upon 1212 Lake Street to play volleyball, softball, eat lunch, fight, argue, swear at each other, which we had to pay for. We were fined by putting money in a jar, depending on what we said. I brought my three little boys with me every Saturday. And at school, then the teacher would have them write stories about what they did on the weekend. And they would always write about Clancy in the yard. So one time the teacher asked one of them, "Who's this Clancy? Is he one of your uncles?" My son said, "No, he's an alcoholic like my mother is." And I loved his quick wit and his snappy remarks. And years ago, we could actually go to the airport and meet somebody when they came in. And I was a little bit restless. So I would make up these elaborate disguises because I wanted to try to trick him and catch him off guard. So my favorite one was this very elaborate nun outfit that I made. I looked like the flying nun, actually. And I waited until he was walking down the corridor. And then I sidled up next to him and I put my arm through his and I whispered, "Would you like to get into the habit?" And it did it in a matter of seconds. He was yelling very loud, "All you Catholics ever want is money. Get away from me." So I walked way ahead of him. And then he was yelling, "Sister, sister, you've got my wallet." And I'm surprised we never got arrested in the airport. But in 2014, I was reunited with a son that I gave up for adoption in 1960. And after I got to know him, I wanted him to meet the famous Clancy who meant so much to me. So I want to preface this by saying I have five alcoholic brothers who Clancy has met, and my maiden name was Flatley. So I brought my son Tom to the meeting. I introduced him to Clancy, who said, "You look just like those Flatley boys. I better check my wallet." So I just loved that about him. He always made us laugh. And we learned practical lessons from him also, which people have mentioned previous to me. We used to like to ride with him when he spoke at local meetings around here, and he would say, meet in my driveway at 6:30. And at 6:30, the car's backing out of the driveway. One night we're driving up the street and one lady was late by seconds, and she was frantically waving her arms, and Clancy kept going, and he just pointed to his watch and kept going. So it's been very important to me to learn to be on time. One of those nights he was going to speak at a small clubhouse, and it so happened the Dodgers were in a playoff game that night, but he went anyway and he spoke to about 10 people. So he did teach us to keep commitments and to do what we said we were going to do. He had a very caring and warm heart. When I was a single mom living in Santa Monica, Santa Claus would leave wrapped up presents on my front porch on Christmas Eve for my kids. My husband, Ed, and I were both sponsored by Clancy, and we got married in his office at the Midnight Mission, the old one, Third in Los Angeles. And our wedding picture is a picture of us with Clancy with a big crown on his head holding the big book and acting like he is marrying us. And the very next year we moved to Minnesota, and he of course suggested that we start a meeting, which we did. It's called Central Pacific, and in about a week it will be 31 years old. And one of the main reasons it is successful still is because Clancy came just about every single year and spoke at our meeting, and there was always such excitement in the air, and the words spread around that he is coming. So he will be deeply missed by all of us, but his message and his example will live on through us, and we will all move forward, as he would say, safe, sane, and sober. Thank you.
Thank you, Nancy. Next, we're going to hear from Nathan Dixon.
My name is Nathan Dixon. I'm an alcoholic. I am honored to be asked to speak at Clancy's memorial. A little bit surprised. I'm sure a lot of people watching think they might be more deserving of my time, but nonetheless, here I am. It's hard for me to condense my memories of Clancy. I came to the Pacific Group. I was a young man. My life was over. It was... there was nothing left. My light was out, no hope for anything, and I had not much to look forward to. I'm sober 35 years today, married, just celebrated 26 years, married to Trish. Our third son is a sophomore at a good school in New York City, and everything I have in my life has come to me through the Pacific Group, through Clancy, and through people he taught AA to. The three most influential men in my life were Chuck Nesbitt, Byron Wallin, and Bill Dixon, all of them Clancy disciples. They loved Clancy. They followed him. They learned a lot from him. And so the two things I want to talk about, the biggest thing I think about when I think about Clancy, thank you. I really believe that being a member of the Pacific Group, being a past secretary of the Pacific Group, these are not small things in my life. These are big things in my life, and I believe that everything in my life today has come to me through the Pacific Group, through a higher power, through Clancy Emerson. I'm deeply, deeply grateful for that. The second thing I think about a lot when I think about Clancy is our trips we took to Florida. And I regret not sending more Florida pictures. I have some old ones for the slideshow. But in 1965, our international convention was in Toronto. My uncle Bill Dixon met Clancy. They became friends. And for the 5 years that followed, Uncle Bill would travel around the country where Clancy was speaking, and they became friends. In 1970, the international convention was in Miami, where Bill Wilson gave his best talk. My uncle Bill and Clancy were in attendance there. And they, after that convention, they drove to Naples, Florida, where my uncle had a home. Couple of LA guys and some Pittsburgh guys spent a few days there. They had a good time, and they decided to return there in October of 1970 to celebrate Clancy's birthday. In 1999, they invited me to go with them. It was Byron Wallin's idea that I go. He wanted some young people in that group. That group named themselves the Knights of Humility Extraordinaire. And it was my honor to, last year was my 20th year traveling down there with those guys. I spent a lot of time, it was the one place where Clancy loved it because he was treated more like one of the guys and less like a leader, the leader of our group. And he really loved it. He loved it down there and he loved us giving him a hard time and he would give us a hard time. And it was a lot of memories walking on the beach. My father died a couple of years ago with 48 years of sobriety. Clancy talked about walking with my father when he was 6 months sober in his first year of sobriety on that same beach in Naples. He walked with me on that beach many times and he explained AA to me how it works better than it's ever been explained. And I'm just grateful for the time there and for the memory. And I too, as said as earlier, I believe it's my obligation to practice what Clancy taught us, what Chuck and Byron and Uncle Bill and Clancy taught us. And I shave every day. I try to treat AA with respect. If I'm asked to do something in AA, I do it. But more than that, the be where you say you're going to be, do what you say you're going to do, I believe is meant for work and my marriage and my children and my family. And he taught me to take what he taught us in the Pacific group and use it outside. And that is the secret to success in my life. I've tried to practice these principles in all my affairs. And, it's an honor for me to be here, be with these, a part of these people, and thank you. Good afternoon.
Thank you, Nathan, very much. Next, may we hear from Larry Adamson.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you, Steve and the family, for the honor to speak today. Good afternoon, everyone. On August 24th, I did something that I don't often do. I went on social media and I wrote, "Today, a great man has been called to his place in God's kingdom." I went on to say that everywhere I traveled and spoke, as the president and the CEO of the Midnight Mission, Clancy's name would immediately become the subject. Now, it usually took the form of three questions. First, a passionate, "You know Clancy?" To which I answered simply, "Yes." Next, an inquisitive, "So you are the president and he works for you?" And my answer again was, "Well, yes." Then came the real question that they wanted to ask me. "So what's that like?" There, the answer was not short and it wasn't simple. Clancy was so many things. He was a mentor, an educator, a humanitarian, a philosopher, and one of the greatest storytellers of our time. I came to the mission in 1994 as a member of its board first, and then in 1988, I became its CEO. What I brought was my executive leadership and business experience, and he had already brought his exceptional understanding of the human psyche and a passion for the 12-step philosophy, its principles, its values, and its traditions. And together, we worked as colleagues, not as boss-employee, as colleagues. We each bringing our passion for helping those who struggle to find their place and meaning in life, those ravaged from the effects of alcohol and drugs and alone without a value system to guide them. Now, I must admit, however, Clancy always wasn't the easiest to understand and relate to. I'm sure most of you on this call have heard Clancy's version of his first experience with the Midnight Mission, how he got to LA via jail stops in Texas and Arizona, and walked into the mission absent his front teeth, which he had involuntarily deposited in a cell in Arizona. And after not too long of insisting that he knew more than anyone that ran the mission, he found himself mid-air as he sailed back through the doors that he had entered. And there is where he proved to also be a psychic as well. As he stood at the front doors that he had just been thrown out of and proclaimed, "I'll be back to get you guys." Now, knowing Clancy, I'm not sure that was exactly his words, but he did keep his word. And in 1974, he returned to claim his place as the executive director, where he served for the last 46 years. And together, we served for the last 26 years. Clancy, to a certain degree, was a contradiction. Brilliant, absolutely brilliant, but at times scatterbrained. Compassionate, but at times brutally direct. Thoughtful, but absolutely impatient. Now, what he wasn't a fashion leader. Unless coffee stains on your shirt, your tie, your pants, and your coat was fashionable. And as you already heard, he wasn't a great driver. He always had a large car, however, a Crown Vic, a Mercury Grand Marquis, and he succeeded in repairing every fender, door, and bumper on every one of them multiple times. When we moved into the new mission, I had to give him a special parking space because no one wanted to park next to him. In fact, we sat down and attended every day when he showed up so that he could get out of his car and the attendant could park it for him. But there is one thing that was never, never a contradiction, and to which he had unswerving devotion: his dedication to his fellow human being. In that post I did on August 24th, I further said, he was a man who has had more impact on humanity than anyone that I have ever had the privilege to know. Thousands of lives changed for the better. He understood that in the end, it's not what we buy, but it is what we build. It is not what we get, but it is what we give. To that end, Clancy, you lived a life that mattered. To that end, you proved that life has meaning. Soft and safe be thy resting place, my brother, until we meet again, until we meet again.
Thank you, Larry. Next, can we hear from Ed Begley?
Hi, I'm Ed Begley, and I'm grateful to be here today. I'm an alcoholic. And Clancy was a dear friend. My job today is to send boundless love and light to my dear friend Clancy, to his wonderful family, to the many people that he's brought into my life, like Larry Adamson, who just spoke so eloquently. The mission was so lucky to have him for so many years. Steve Watson has been such a good friend to me and to Clancy. His devotion to Clancy and the program and sobriety is just something that inspires me. Mike, the current executive director of the Midnight Mission, doing a wonderful job. Clancy brought wonderful people into my life. He touched my life from the beginning. I came into the program in 1976, and first meeting I went to, I heard a guy called Norm Alpe speak, and he was great. It was just what I needed. He was funny and smart and wore a suit, and it really grabbed me. Well, I met another man who was very funny and smart and wore a suit, and that was Clancy. And the first 20 years of my sobriety, I had one sponsor who was wonderful, worked the steps with me and did everything with me that I needed to do, and he was very kind. But I realized for the second 20 years of my sobriety, I needed somebody that wasn't quite as kind. I needed Clancy, and he really fit the bill. Clancy early on got me involved, long before he was my sponsor in the mission, helping out financially when I could when I was working. And I had occasion to go down to the mission fairly early on in our friendship. I was doing a part in a movie where I had to play a homeless person. I went down to do a bit of research to see how homeless people behaved. And he was helpful to me, but what I liked instantly, it was so great and important to see, was how he warned me and cautioned me about how I behaved, that I didn't do anything that was slightly disrespectful to these people. He was protecting their dignity, these people that were going into the midnight mission for a meal and sometimes a lot more. And he was more careful with them and the way they felt than me, which was perfect, of course. It was what it should have been. And so then sometime later, I got involved with the midnight mission. But before that, even, I remember one important time when I called him up about something I was having trouble with, my personal trainer or my, you know, transmission of my car or my, you know, pet sitter or something minor. And he said, "I'm sorry, Ed, I can't hear what you're saying right now. I have a man dying at my feet. We just pulled in off San Pedro Street. Just if you can speak up a little louder. There's a couple of guys actually dying at my feet as you're telling me about your Debutantes for Peace event and your Tofu Guild meeting. Very important stuff, but just speak a little louder, Ed." And then he gave me the great honor of asking me to be on the board of the Midnight Mission, where I served for years. And just so grateful to Stephen Doan and all the wonderful board members and Jared Chamalis. And I got to know these people better because of Clancy. He gave me so many gifts. He kept me sober. He kept me sane. He was there for me whenever I needed him. And I've gotten to know his wonderful daughters too. I just send them boundless love and light. What a great man, what a great family. How lucky are we to have known him. And thank you again, Steve Watson, every single person who's here today. Bless you all.
Thank you, Ed. May we now hear from Clancy's daughter, Mary.
Thank you. I hope I can do this without crying. I've been feeling so jolly, but suddenly I'm choked up. I'm Mary, and I'm Clancy's daughter. And seeing all these faces that I love so much that I've known my whole life, PG, you are our extended family, is so touching. And thank you for letting me represent the family. That's a big honor and a big responsibility. I was telling my sisters about that. We could not have put this together. We couldn't have made a memorial. We're too devastated still. We miss our father so much. And now we're orphans, so that's very hard too. But we love it that you've put this together today. And we've talked to many of you about maybe doing an in-person Zoom memorial service next year. Not Zoom, an in-person memorial service where we can all hug. And that's what I miss. I love this today. I love the video. I loved what I've heard, but I wish I could hug you, and that's hard. It's hard to just be on a screen. But anyway, so I was telling my sisters yesterday, since I'm the representative, what should I say? Fortunately, you've given me this extra hour. I thank you for that, so that I can say everything I need to say. But I was saying to my sisters, what can I say? And we started reminiscing about the old days, and we laughed and laughed and laughed. It was one of the most pleasant times I've ever had. We were on Zoom for about 2-4 hours just laughing. And we finally decided that what I should talk about, and I should try to make it succinct, is when PG started, because I am the only person alive, I think, right now who was at the first meeting. But I was. And I remember why it started. My father wanted to be secretary of his group. He had 5 years of recovery. He was feeling really proud. He had a following, you know, in the group. He had lobbied people to vote for him. And they were having the secretary's election. And he was going to get it. And he was all ready. But then the opposing people brought in a bunch of ringers, as he puts it, on a bus. And they voted, and so he didn't win. And he was so mad because it was so unfair that he took his coffee pot and he found another place. And that was Tuesday Night Ohio Street, which is PG. And I remember him sitting at home fuming about it. My mother, Charlotte, was there as she was with him every step of the way. And they sat down at the kitchen table. And he wrote out the format he wanted his group, his new group that he was going to start to have. He sat and wrote it. Now, I've heard him in recent years talk about how he got together with a few other people and they created it. But that's, he sat and he wrote it. And the only people there were my mother and us kids. And we were all running around not paying any attention. But they wrote it out. He practiced it. He went in. They took me. They used to always take me to meetings, I think because they anticipated my own problems that were going to soon follow when I became a teenager. But it was the two of them and me and about four or five other people. I remember Smokey Newton and his wife, Mariana. And I remember Luann Sims. And I remember Wayne Franklin. And I can say their names because they're all dead now. But they just sat there and they had their meeting and I ate the cookies. And they started doing that every Tuesday night. And pretty soon, four people changed, became eight people and became 12 people. And then, about 3 years later, Smokey Newton, my father's dear friend, who he had started the meeting with, and he had a small falling out. Well, it was a pretty big falling out, because Smokey left and started his own meeting with half of the group, who by now were like, it was 30 people, so. And Dad stayed with PG. And Mom went to every meeting too. Mom was really an important part. And she would help with all, what they did, it was a small group, so they'd come over to the house afterwards, and they would, all the birthday parties were at the house, and they were always on a school night, so I vividly remember that I could never do my homework. And it gave me a very cavalier attitude towards my education because I thought socializing was a lot more important and it certainly was more fun. And Luann Sims would sit and she would sing with her beautiful voice. She was a very famous singer. And pretty soon Chick Parnell joined the group and he would play the piano and Joe Harnell. And I don't know if Chick Parnell played the piano, but he was a musician. And Joe Harnell would play the piano and my dad would play the piano. Because the thing about Dad is he was a musical genius and he played totally by ear. And when he was in college, he had just finished and somebody got him for another university to study his complex rendition of Ebb Tide. Because the musicologists could not believe that somebody who'd never had any training could possibly do that. So they recorded it, they studied it, and he was a brilliant musician, and people who've known him for a long time know that. But it's something that I do not remember us ever moving into a house where we didn't have a piano first, before we had a kitchen table, before we had a sofa, before we had beds, the piano was in there. And the 4th of July in the early group, we would always have it in the yard and Dad would have everybody move the piano out onto the patio where he and Joe Harnell would fight over who got to play first. And then Dad would lead us in rousing songs, most of them kind of ribald, and that he loved so much, like the Boy Scouts marching song and things like that, that some of you remember. And I think of the group, Nancy is the only person I remember from those early yards. And she scandalized me because she was always having a bare midriff. And I was still a really kind of good Catholic girl at that time. I dreamed of sin, but I didn't really want it in the backyard. And today I'm so grateful for her and how she's helped me keep my sobriety. At any rate, I guess I should stop. I have two more things I want to say about Dad, though. 8 years ago, we were having a memorial service, and most of you were there for my mother. Because oddly, she died at just this time of year. These are the days of awe, 10 days of amazing miracles in my husband's tradition. And she died at this same time. And we had her memorial service during the days of awe, and Dad officiated at it. And so it's so odd that he died, but I remember after she died, he came up to me and, because my father and I, our father, because I can say this for all my siblings, Christine, Kathy, Susie, and Clancy John, we spent a lot of time with him at the end of his life, and he tried so hard to be everything to us. And he was talking to me one day, and he said, "Mary, let me tell you what happened to me. It was the strangest experience." And he told me about how he'd been at a conference in the Midwest, and he had heard an Al-Anon speaker. And he didn't have to go to the airport yet, so he sat and listened to it. And he said she talked about what it was like to be married to an alcoholic, both when he was drinking and in recovery. And Dad said, "Mary, for the first time, I realized what your mother's life must have been like." He said, "I always looked at it from my point of view. I never understood what it was like for her." And he said, "I was haunted by it. And all the way home on the 8-hour trip on the planes," he said, "I thought about it. And I thought, what can I do? How can I ever make it up to her?" And he said he came into the house and it was very late and she was asleep. So he didn't want to wake her up. So he sat down and he wrote her a letter about it and acknowledging it and how much he loved her. And he left it on the kitchen table. And the next morning, to his surprise, she was not up before him. She usually was. So he got ready and went to work and just left it on the table. And at about 9:45 that morning, he got a phone call from our dog walker, Sunny, who said, "I just came in to walk the dogs, and Charlotte's dead." And she had found Mom sitting at the table, sitting straight up with this look on her face. Sunny said she couldn't believe she was dead because she had a smile kind of on her face. And she was looking up and the sun was pouring into her face. And that note was in front of her. And Dad looked at me with tears in his eyes and he said, "I am so grateful to God that that happened, that I was able to make my amends, even though it was just a letter at the end of her life." So I'm thinking about that today because this is just about exactly the day that we had the conversation 8 years ago. And I'm thinking about how much... how amazing, what a brilliant man my father was, and how he was something different to each of us. We all have a kaleidoscope of ways to look at him, and I love hearing all the ways that you see him. And I love having this extended family, and I know that my whole family does because we've talked about it. And when my dad was dying, I just want to say two things. I just said that, but I'm just going to add one more tiny one and then one other tiny one. I want to say how much I appreciate the love and support that has poured in on us. I've never felt anything like this in my life, nor have my sisters, and nor has my brother, I don't think, although he's a little more elusive and hard to get a hold of. But it has been overwhelming. It is just such to me a representation of what Dad meant in the world. And all the times I felt sorry for myself because my dad was on the road and my dad wasn't at my graduation and my dad was here or there, I realized that it's a trade-off. That's the beauty of this program. We get love and we give love. And it's just one big experience. And the other thing I wanted to say was, I wanted to talk about the day Dad died because I was very intimately connected with him for that last 3 months of his life. That last day he was in the COVID isolation unit, getting out. He was supposed to get out. I was on the phone arguing with his doctor all morning. "Yes, we want to take him home." And I hung up the phone, and the next call I got was from the nurse. And she said, "He's dead." And what happened was he hadn't been talking that day. And she said, then he started to seem to come to consciousness. And he said, "Charlotte, Charlotte." And then he just went to sleep in the most peaceful way. And she went out for lunch. And when she came back, he was dead. And what I believe, what I choose to believe today, is that my mother was there, taking him by the hand and helping him transition. And I don't feel like we go that far away. My dad did not believe that we really die. He believed in life after death. And I think he's with all of us. And all we have to do is say, be willing, and say, help me, and he will. Thank you.
Thank you, Mary. Now may we hear from Tim Kruger.
Good afternoon. My name is Tim Kruger, and I'm an alcoholic. And it's really my great privilege to be with you this afternoon to honor the life of this remarkable, incredible man. I too would like to express my gratitude to the Emmislin family for sharing Clancy with all of us. Your sacrifice has had an impact on an incalculable number of lives, and we thank you. You know, when you think about it, there are very few people that have touched as many lives directly as Clancy Emmislin. He was known throughout the world for his service to others. His years of service brought with it a great degree of notoriety and celebrity. He was an iconic figure. I mean, Clancy was a rock star. I was fortunate enough to know Clancy as simply the guy that I walked into the Wednesday night meeting with Johnny Harris every Wednesday night, who attended my 60th birthday party at Angel Stadium and who came to our home last holiday season and led everybody in singing Christmas carols, and who had just a profound impact on my life for the past 35 years. It's difficult for me to characterize my relationship with Clancy. He was never my sponsor, but he always guided me. He was not really a father figure to me, but he treated me like a son. And we didn't hang out together all the time, but he was my friend. And so I am grieving his loss in a very personal way, and I miss him. I first met Clancy in 1985 when, like many others before me, I called him because I was deeply troubled and I was desperate. He didn't know me at all, but he took that call and invited me to visit him at the Midnight Mission. When I arrived, he handed me a cup of not-so-great coffee, and he sat patiently and listened to me explain to him how there was no possible solution to my circumstances. And then he looked at me, and in this self-assured way, he laid out a series of actions that he suggested I take. I'm not sure Clancy ever suggested anything, but he was pretty clear that this is what I needed to do if I wanted to change my life. And these things that he was telling me to do were terrifying, and they were impactful, and they were life-changing. And I had just met this man, but there was something about Clancy that led you to trust him. And I believed in him, even though I had just met him. And that day, and Clancy's continuing presence in my life since then has changed the course of my life forever. You know, the public Clancy was dynamic and bold, brash, flawed, and a lightning rod for criticism. Much of it deserved. He could carve someone up in three sentences. But there was another side of Clancy as well. When my oldest daughter, Kristen, was born, I called to tell him about the birth of our first child, and he congratulated me and wished me well. It was a really sort of a nondescript conversation, but 3 days later, a card showed up at my house in the mail. It was from Clancy, and it had a heartfelt message in it and a check for $20 to start Kristen's college fund. And I thought, here's this guy who is as busy as anyone could possibly be, who took the time to buy a card, write a message, and put it in the mail to me. It's just a little thing. And not to ruin his reputation or anything, but it was really kind and it was thoughtful. And it meant the world to me. It still means the world to me to this day, because this is one of the things that Clancy taught me. He taught me that it's little things that sometimes are the most meaningful to people. That it's one thing to tell people that you care about them or that you love them, but it's something altogether different to act that way. You know, Clancy leaves many legacies behind, perhaps none as meaningful as his beloved Pacific Group, a group he founded in 1963, a group that has really changed the lives of thousands of people and the lives of thousands of people who care about those folks. And so there's a question that sort of lingers. What happens to the Pacific Group now? But there's a simple answer. We will argue and we will judge each other and we will have our share of troubles, but mostly we will continue to share each other's lives, to care about one another, to love one another through our actions, the way Clancy taught us to do. This is how we can best honor his life and take care of the great gift that he has given us. The Pacific Group is something truly special. It's up to us to keep it going, and we will. You know, I started talking initially about my grief, and as I have thought about it, that's somewhat emotionally self-indulgent. Clancy lived a long, full life. He got as much out of his time on this earth as anyone could possibly get. His was a life of consequence. So if there is a life to be celebrated, truly celebrated in every sense of the word, it is the life of Clancy Emlisten. Thank you.
Thank you, Tim. Clancy gave me a poem that he wanted read by his granddaughter, Katie Doherty. And if she wouldn't terribly mind reading that poem.
Thanks. Thanks, Steve. Okay, I'm sorry. I just wanted to say quickly, thank you to everyone. And, you know, as everyone has described, my grandpa had a really big personality, but it was never so big that he couldn't see suffering, fragility and quiet suffering in people and dogs. And he saw it in his life work. His life's work was to mend it with hope and compassion and dignity. And Grandpa restored hope where it was needed. And his choice of this poem so perfectly demonstrates that. It's a final gift to everyone who misses him. When I first saw the poem, I didn't understand why he would set it aside years ago. But then I realized it's a gift. It's his final gift to everyone who misses him so much. And also in the spirit of this poem, I think he wants to be remembered, not by necessarily a somber background, but probably with something a little bit more dynamic and specifically of himself looking amazing. So here it is. Do not stand at my grave and weep. I am not there. I do not sleep. I am 1,000 winds that blow. I am the diamond glints on snow. I am the sunlight on ripened grain. I am the gentle autumn rain
when you awaken in the morning's hush, I am the swift uplifting rush of quiet birds in circled flight. I am the soft stars that shine at night. Do not stand at my grave and cry. I am not there. I did not die. Thank you.
Thank you, Katie. And we all know like Clancy likes to direct things. And so he also left a song, and I may have Nordic blood, but if I mispronounce it, I apologize to all true Norwegians. He wanted a hymn that was sung at his father's funeral, his grandfather's funeral, his great-grandfather's funeral. It's called Den Store Havik Folk. And in English, it would be called, it is called the Great White Host. As we get ready to conclude this, I want to thank everybody who have came here today to participate. I would also like to thank all the participants and everybody that's joining. I want to thank the Imlisland family. My dad died, oops, when I was a young man. And Clancy gave my life purpose and meaning. And he showed me such great love. And I know he was sharing the love that he shares for his children. So thank you for letting me be a part of your family. I love you. And he always liked a little poem. You can see the poem. It's written right here. And it says something like this. My eyes are watering. Excuse me. Of these things does my wealth consist. A sunset skies bathed in amethyst, of emerald seascapes roaring wild, of golden forests undefiled, of diamond teardrops glittering bright, of pearl-like snowflakes drifting white. But most of all, now that everything's said, I wish you love and laughter and good days ahead. I love you and thank you. And thank you for everybody that made this possible. We're gonna play a little video, and after there's gonna be a virtual reception room that will be in the chat. The people that know how to do that will take care of it and put it there. But thank you very much and thank you for being here.
My name is Clancy Emerson. I'm an alcoholic. I'm Clancy. Alcoholics Anonymous is a great traditional thing. And I, like most of the people here, hope it stays the way it is, because it's the only thing that's ever worked for people like you and me. I'm glad that over the years I came to believe in a loving God. That's one of the great things. I'll tell you something else that I came to do. I would have never guessed in many years. I've lost my fear of death. Because I really feel there's got to be something beyond this. I got to feel this. Go over there and Jimmy Lee Shaw, make him get me a cup of coffee the first day. That's what I'll do. And try to avoid Chuck Chamberlain so I don't have to get him one.
Some small thing I did 45 years ago. Don't bring this about. We must keep it going. Thank you.
I've had the opportunity to do all these things, and I have stayed active. Now, all the things I've done, what's the most important thing I did? Just staying active in my group. That's the most important thing I've done. Some of the players are a little plump, but they still can pitch well. Here's a plump pitcher. So every time I see where there's young people enthusiastic, I feel there's hope for aid.
The purpose of AA is to very slowly do what alcohol did fast, to little by little change my perception of reality, to change my relationship to the world around me, to enable me to live with some degree of dignity and peace and self-respect, and live in the world that I would have sworn I could not live in.
I can tell you on behalf of hundreds of thousands of people who have felt just like you, that there's a way out.
I hope that you can surrender and begin to find it. I hope that one day your hopelessness will return to hope, as mine did. That your helplessness will enable you to be of help to others, as mine has. I hope you can find peace. I wish you well.